vision or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Claudia, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, November 9th issue of the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. When MAGA Met Private Equity. A newly elected Republican senator promised hope for a dying Ohio paper mill and its unionized workers, then reality set in. One by one, black cars with tinted windows pulled up to the parking lot in the shadow of the paper mill. The governor of Ohio exited one car, one U.S. senator appeared, then the other. They were joined by the congressional representative from the district and the state attorney general. The lineup of heavy political hitters had turned out in early April to show their support for the 850 employees who had been delivered a gut punch days earlier when the private equity firm that owns the Chillicothe, Ohio paper mill announced it was closing the plant in 60 days. The politicians had come to deliver encouragement but also good news. The newly elected Senator Bernie Moreno told the crowd that he had just received a phone call from a top executive at the private equity firm promising that the facility would remain open until the end of the year, giving it more time to find a new owner. The mill's rescue was not assured. Mr. Moreno and the other politicians cautioned, but it was hard to find anyone in the crowd not buoyed by what Mr. Moreno called a day of hope. It was amazing, said Jeff Allen, the president of the union local and third-generation papermaker, who also addressed the crowd in April. I'm sitting there with the governor, two sitting U.S. senators, the district congressman, all the state officials. My votes didn't put any of them in office. Historically, this union supported Democrats, and yet here are all these Republicans supporting us. This could be a new paradigm, he thought. Donald J. Trump's promise to revive manufacturing in the United States had appealed to working-class voters around the country last November, including many of Mr. Allen's co-workers. Now here was Mr. Moreno, a Make America Great Again standard bearer, forcefully pounding the table for union jobs. In a matter of days, it seemed like Mr. Moreno had, almost Trump-like, bent a private equity titan to his will, threatening in a blistering letter to conduct a federal investigation into the portfolio of businesses held by the firm HIG Capital. When Mr. Moreno had announced on the stage that the firm's chastened leaders had given the workers another 6 months, he added that he would be rolling up his sleeves to help find a buyer. The senator gave Mr. Allen his cell phone number and said an aide would be moving to Chillicothe to provide boots-on-the-ground help. As Ohio continues to carve a new economic path, that April rally provided a vision. As an ever-deeper red state, the home of central MAGA characters like Vice President J.D. Vance, the gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, and Mr. Moreno, it could muscle its way to greater prosperity not only through a boom in artificial intelligence data centers across the state, but by turning back the clock through tariffs, coal, and industrial manufacturing. It might be too late for the steel mills in Youngstown, the rubber plants in Akron, and the glass factories in Toledo. But maybe, Mr. Allen hoped, the paper mill in Chillicothe would be different. A steady decline. South of Columbus on U.S. Route 23, the paper mill's 475-foot-tall red and white-ringed smokestack is visible from miles away. For more than a century, the paper mill was owned by the Meade family, the maker of notebooks, for generations of school children. Chillicothe was the epitome of a company town. The Meade company built a swimming pool that cost 25 cents for workers' families to use and supported two amateur baseball teams on fields it built. There was a time when workers would cash their paychecks at the Pink Grill, a watering hole next to the mill where they would throw back cold beers and wrap both hands around a paper maker, a double-decker cheeseburger with 10 ounces of ground beef. But mill work took a physical toil. If you've been at the mill long enough, you know a story or two about gruesome injury or death. Then there were the swing shifts, overtime hours, and missed birthdays and anniversaries, too many to count. The 1990s marked the beginning of the mill's steady decline. With the dawn of the digital age, there was less need for paper. The mill underwent a steady churn of owners. Three of its past four owners have been private equity firms, including HIG Capital, which manages a $70 billion portfolio. 3 years ago, Miami-based HIG bought Pixel Specialty Solutions, which operated the mill. In the paper industry, private equity has often followed a familiar playbook: buy a distressed asset on the cheap and load it with debt, some of which is used to pay the private equity firm. Then in a few years, the private equity firm sells the company or declares bankruptcy. As the mill changed hands over the years, it was rarely good for the rank and file. Interviews with more than two dozen current and former employees describe the past 25 years as a period of underinvestment, poor management, and declining morale. There have been more than a dozen mill managers in the past two decades. Maintenance and engineering departments withered, and in late 2022, about 90 veteran mill workers retired suddenly, creating a knowledge deficit that further crippled the operation. There were safety issues, too. In June, the Chillicothe Fire Department was called in to help extinguish a fire that had started when sawdust piled up on an electrical panel. It was the second time in 15 months that the department was called in to help because the company's own firefighting unit was overwhelmed, according to Chillicothe Fire Department records. Blindsided by a decision, Mr. Moreno, whose family emigrated from Colombia when he was a child, made his fortune building an auto dealership empire in the northern Ohio. He was elected in 2024 after an expensive, sharp elbowed campaign in which he leaned heavily on support from Mr. Trump. Mr. Moreno narrowly beat out Sherrod Brown, a liberal Democrat and stalwart union supporter, with a 50.2% of the vote. In an interview this summer, Mr. Moreno said his North Star was his father-in-law, who went to work at the U.S. Steel plant in Gary, Indiana. The day after his high school graduation, raised a family, owned a car, took vacations, and retired with total dignity and no debt. Sometimes people think that American dream is Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, he said, but most Americans aspire to have a good, normal life. Mr. Moreno had held the office for only 4 months when HIG Capital announced in April that it would be shuttering the paper mill. The announcement blindsided not only the workers, but was a shock to the state's political leaders, who in recent years have aggressively sought to stanch the bleeding of blue union workers. Some voiced their anger, others pledged support for the workers. Mr. Moreno jumped in with a fire-breathing letter to HIG Capital's top executives that hit on a familiar populist theme. Regular folks are losing out, in this case, to rich guys in Miami. I'm here to inform you that such treacherous, self-serving, and destructive behavior must end now, Mr. Moreno wrote, noting that HIG Capital had driven several companies into bankruptcy. He demanded to know the financial terms of the acquisition, the yearly balance sheets for the mill, and how much top executives profited. He also threatened to pursue Department of Justice and Department of Treasury investigations of companies owned by HIG Capital. I was extraordinarily pissed off, Mr. Moreno said, but that anger had a short shelf life. On the morning before he spoke to the crowd in April, Mr. Moreno took a call from Brian Schwartz, a co-president of HIG Capital, from inside a Chillicothe donut shop. Mr. Schwartz, sounding apologetic, agreed to keep the plant open until the end of the year while helping find a buyer, according to Mr. Moreno. HIG Capital never announced a six-month extension. Mr. Schwartz did not respond to messages seeking comment. The senator was determined to find a new owner. He helped stir up a steady stream of potential buyers who were led around the paper mill. Some of the biggest names in the paper industry had a look, according to two people familiar with the visits who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the visits were supposed to be confidential. International Paper, Smurfit, Restruck, and Packaging Corporation of America, the companies declined to comment or did not respond to an interview request. But the mill would have needed hundreds of millions of dollars in investment in new or reconfigured machines over the past 15 years in order to pivot from its primary product, carbon-less paper that has largely been made obsolete with the digitalization of finance and medical forms, said a former plant manager who spoke on the condition of anonymity because he still works in the paper industry. Faced with this reality, HIG couldn't even give the mill away. Tyler Rajeski, the chief executive of Twin Rivers Paper in Madawaska, Maine, told his local town council in May that he offered the chance to buy Chillicothe for a dollar, and I said no. Not just dumb rednecks. Mr. Moreno returned to Chillicothe again on the first Saturday in June, not for a rally, but to deliver grim news to the union's leadership. HIG Capital would be closing the mill on August 10th, not at the end of the year, as the private equity firm had initially promised him. Mr. Moreno said he had come to understand HIG Capital's plight. The mill had been hemorrhaging customers and employees since it announced the closing, and it was costing the firm millions to keep it open even for a few more months. "I'm a business guy," Mr. Moreno said. "I understand that they were on the path that couldn't be reversed. You realize it's a monumental amount of money they would have had to invest to turn it around." Many of the mill workers were less understanding. The mill had provided generations of workers with solid union wages and health care. It also gave them a sense of identity and a pride of place. Working a union job at the mill is as good as it gets for someone who isn't interested in leaving Chillicothe or going to college. Wages start around $25 per hour and over time often push pay into six figures in a place where that goes a long way. "I don't want you to think we're just dumb rednecks," Thomas Hammer, age 27, said in an interview in June, a few days after a discussion at the union hall with a group of his co-workers veered into why so many of them had chosen not to leave Chillicothe, either to go to college or to pursue other opportunities. "I know a lot of really smart people who work low-budget jobs," he added. "We've all stayed here because it's our home and we don't leave. People here stick together." Mr. Hamner didn't have much growing up. Shortly after he graduated from high school, his grandfather, who had worked at the mill, helped him get a job there. Mr. Hammer earned about $90,000 last year, but it was barely enough to keep pace with his spending and debts. He got a new tractor to work the 5 acres of rocky land he'd bought, but fell behind on payments and sold it for pennies on the dollar. The announcement in April that the mill would be closing came a week after Mr. Hamner learned that his wife, Shaylin, was pregnant with their second child. Their older son, Waylon, is 3. The uncertainty over what's next weighs on Mr. Hamner. "The only time it hit me is when I came to the realization that if my son wants a juice box or cupcakes, I can buy it for him," he said in August. But he's not sure how long this will be true. "At least at this point in his life, I can say Waylon was spoiled and taken care of," he said. "I'm not sure I'll be able to say that with the next one." Winston, their second son, was born a few weeks ago. In late July, a job fair had more than 70 businesses with displays set up inside the local college basketball gym. Cornerstone, Caregiving, Diamond Power, Stewart Glass, Ohio Department of Corrections, Victoria's Secret, a sheet metal apprentice program, and on. Mill employees, some wearing pulp-spattered work boots, walked up and down the aisles of the job fair, waiting for a conversation starter. To some, it was like speed dating. "Hi, what do you do at the mill? What kind of work are you looking for? Here's a list of the jobs we have available." As the job fair drew to a close, it became clear that even promising leads most likely included a pay cut and required a much longer commute or even relocating. Mr. Allen, the union president, spent much of his time arranging a training session for a few dozen workers, hoping it would bolster their skill set and their qualifications for another manufacturing job. "I know the names to the faces," he said of the mill workers. "They mean something to me." No white knight solution. By early September, all that remained at the mill was a skeleton crew that did little more than keep the lights on. Hundreds of workers had received their last paychecks and had started calculating how to stretch out their severance checks while they looked for what's next. By then, Mr. Moreno knew what would become of the site, even though he was not ready to disclose it publicly. It wasn't the white knight solution he had hoped for, but it was still a much better solution than doing what my opponent probably would have done, gone down there, organized a protest, and gone home, Mr. Moreno said, referring to Mr. Brown. "I am willing to sit back and say it is too risky because of what something doesn't work out. I gave it my all." Asked about his more conciliatory approach with HIG Capital, which never turned over the financial details he had requested, Mr. Moreno said, "I applaud HIG for how they've been since then. I don't take anything back of what I said in that letter. I take nothing back what I've said in public. It took them to that to get us to this point." But Mr. Brown, his Democratic opponent in the race last year, said that a broad coalition should have been involved, including union, city, and county workers, to exert pressure on HIG Capitol. He said Mr. Moreno showed his allegiance while he voted for Mr. Trump's tax bill, which has tax benefits that will be a boon for private equity executives like the ones at HIG Capital. We can make speeches, we all do, said Mr. Brown, who is running for Ohio's other Senate seat next year. You can write nasty letters, you can call them out on the Senate floor, but if you're not willing to vote and hold their feet to the fire on tax issues, they don't really care. A sale and more questions. Last month, Mr. Moreno arrived in town to make a grand announcement. The mill had been bought by the U.S. Paper Mill Company, a subsidiary of U.S. Medical Glove Company. A few dozen former paper mill workers crowded around a lectern in front of two rubber glove-making machines that had been hastily installed in a vast warehouse where Mr. Moreno was to speak. The workers, most of them dressed in jeans, T-shirts and work boots, stood elbow to elbow with local political leaders and business people in suits and polished shoes. The workers were eager to hear more about the new venture, which Mr. Moreno told the crowd was just to start. In time, the company might employ 1,500 people and ensure that hospital gloves around the country, the boxes they are shipped in, and the machines that make them in other countries would be manufactured in Chillicothe. He praised Mr. Schwartz, the HIG Capital executive, who said he had agreed to contribute $5.5 million to a fund that would be allotted to the laid-off workers, though almost all of it won't be distributed for 5 years. It was not disclosed how much U.S. Medical Glove paid for the mill facility, but Mr. Moreno declined to answer two fundamental questions. How many jobs would there be to start, and what would they pay? Neither could John Todorki, the owner of U.S. Medical Glove, who did not address the crowd. Mr. Todorki, who peppers conversations with expletives, is not the button-down type. He said in an interview after the ceremony that he would try to pay workers close to what they were previously making at the paper mill, and that he did not want to publicly say how many people he would be hiring. The plan is to see if my plan is going to work, and we won't know for 30 days, he said. And then what? I'm like an old dog with a bone in my jaw, Mr. Todorki said. I don't let go. Several former workers who attended the ceremony said they were hopeful that the new jobs would be a good thing for Chillicothe, even if they had little idea what the jobs were or how much they would pay. Callbacks would not be based on seniority, as the union had negotiated. And what about health benefits, overtime, vacation pay, which might be as many as 5 weeks? Unlike at the old paper mill, these new jobs would not be unionized. As of Thursday, the new company has 70 employees. It's anger and it's hurt, said Mr. Allen, now the former union president, who was laid off at the end of August. That was my life. I went there when I just turned 19, and here I am, 56. I'm angry at the whole process, and I'm hurt for all those employees. Mr. Allen and Mr. Moreno had called to inform him about the sale. Then the senator's aide extended an invitation to speak at the ceremony, celebrating the new ownership. Mr. Allen never responded. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section of the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Swiss dairy cows may pay the price for Trump's tariffs. As a dairy farmer, Boris Barut tends to more than 60 cows in the gently rolling meadowlands of his farm in the Jura region of Switzerland. Their milk, herbaceous and nutty from the tender grasses they graze on, makes fine Swiss cheeses and chocolates, much of it destined for American consumers. But recently, Mr. Barrett sent some of his herd to the slaughterhouse prematurely. Nearly every other Swiss dairy farmer is thinking of whether to follow suit. Since President Trump announced a punishing 39% tariff on Switzerland in August, the blow has landed hard on the Swiss dairy industry, where cheesemakers have cut production to deal with an expected fall off in U.S. demand. The tariffs compound an existing problem. Switzerland has too much milk and too many cows. We need to find a solution with the United States to lower the tariffs, Mr. Barrett said. But if things continue, we need to consider whether we need to start slaughtering more cows. Few things are as symbolic in Switzerland as its dairy cows with their giant copper bells, brown and white coats, and high-quality milk. No one dreamed that an abrupt shift in U.S. trade policy could play a role in a Swiss way of life that dates back to centuries. On Tuesday, Mr. Trump said that he had spoken with Swiss representatives and that the trade talks would continue. A day later, the Supreme Court appeared skeptical about Mr. Trump's authority to impose sweeping tariffs in a landmark case over involving presidential trade powers. But the fallout of tariffs imposed this year on U.S. trading partners has become clearer. Clothing factories have been shuttered in Africa. Auto plants in Europe have been cutting jobs. The stakes have been high for Switzerland, too. Since the announcement, the pastures behind Mr. Barrett's farm have become an example of the consequences of trade war. An abundant season. Mr. Barrett's small dairy farm is one of the 20,000 in Switzerland producing 90% of the nation's milk. Swiss farmers could make more money on an industrial scale, but they prefer to keep tradition alive. Farmers escort cows, around 550,000 all told, up verdant alpine mountains in the summer to feed, producing some of the world's best milk. The cows descend a few months later, often paraded with flower crowns to the sound of yodeling. To ensure the farmer's survival, the Swiss dairy industry sets strict quotas for milk production and prices. But an unusually rainy spring spawned an abundance of grass. Although farmers lately have been battling higher temperatures that have dried up feed, the cows on Mr. Barrett's farm and at others across Switzerland ate so well this year that they produced a bumper milk harvest. That would not have been a big problem because the dairy industry could turn the excess supply into milk powder or frozen butter, said Stefan Kohler, the director of IP Late, which represents the Swiss dairy sector. But when Mr. Trump announced high tariffs, those calculations were thrown off. Cutting cheese production. The United States is Switzerland's biggest market after Europe, importing 13% of Swiss cheese production. Half is premium Gruyere made with alpine milk, but there is also Emmentaler, the cheese with holes, Tiltzer, and Appenzeller. Milk also goes into Swiss chocolate. Anthony Margot, co-owner of Margot Fromages, a 139-year-old company and one of Switzerland's biggest cheese dealers, was shocked when he heard about the new tariff rate. The Swiss had been expecting a duty closer to the 15% secured by the European Union. When combined with other levies and a plunge in the U.S. dollar, the effective tariff on Switzerland tops 50%. Switzerland has no tariffs on most imported goods, but its levies on agricultural imports can top 100% to protect its dairy industry. Maybe from the U.S. point of view, that's not fair, he said, but neither, he said, were Mr. Trump's tariffs. When the newly levy inflated Switzerland's tax rate on exports to the United States, prices soared, and the Gruyere industry urged cheesemakers to cut output by 5%. The impact was direct, said Mr. Margot, whose company matures 10% of Switzerland's Gruyere production. Around 36,000 wheels rest in cellars before being shipped to 40 countries, including the United States, where he exports 4,500 tons of Gruyere. Buyers include Sam's Club, Costco, and Murray's Cheese in New York. Cheese that was priced at $15 to $50 per pound now costs $20 to $70, he said. Thinning the herd with less cheese to make, the IP Late industry group urged action to limit price declines that could hurt farmers. We already had excess production due to good weather, but Donald Trump's decision made the glass overflow, Mr. Kohler said. The organization recommended cutting annual milk production by 50,000 tons, the amount produced by 25,000 cows, Mr. Kohler said. The fastest route, he said, would be for cows to be slaughtered sooner than usual. Mr. Barrett, who is also president of Swiss Milk, a producers association, has already done so. He sent three dairy cows to the slaughterhouse prematurely to reduce milk supplies, and he might cull more. He said farmers were reluctant to reduce herd sizes quickly in case a lower tariff was negotiated. In Switzerland, the cow is almost a sacred animal, he said. If you say you have to kill more cows, that sends shockwaves. That includes Swiss cattle farms that raise a breed of cows for steaks. They worry that a sudden supply of excess meat could harm their prices. Around 85,000 Swiss dairy cows are culled annually as they age and produce less milk. They are replaced with younger cows, and their meat is used for hamburger and pet food. Mr. Kohler said any further slaughter, should it happen, would be carried out slowly. It's not like thousands of cows would be killed suddenly, he said. Farmers would choose to thin herds more quickly than normal in the next couple of months, he added, looking for alternatives. By far, though, the preference is to find other ways to deal with excess milk. Ideas include making mozzarella rather than importing it from Italy, making more yogurt, or running solidarity ad campaigns urging the Swiss to eat more dairy. Some farmers have suggested feeding cows a little less so they do not produce as much milk. Mr. Trump's tariffs have pushed the Swiss government to accelerate international trade deals elsewhere, including Latin America, India, and China, which is becoming more open to Swiss dairy products. Americans should know that the whole world is starting to organize trade without the United States, Mr. Kohler said. Gruyere makers are trying to make the most of a glum situation. With the price of gold near record highs and Switzerland a global hub for gold bars, the industry has started a U.S. marketing campaign to play off the higher prices. We're saying Gruyere is the new gold of Switzerland, said Pierre-Yves Guyot, president of the Gruyere Interprofessional Association. The hope is that American consumers will be willing to shell out for the luxury of real Gruyere rather than copies made elsewhere. After slashing exports in August, producers sent more Gruyere to the United States in September ahead of the Christmas season. As for Swiss cows, Mr. Barout said farmers would keep working toward a solution. We will try to do the least amount of slaughter possible, he said. Then when we have passed the difficult period, Switzerland can bounce back. $40 billion, the price Kimberly-Clark agreed to pay for Kenvue, the embattled maker of Tylenol. The consumer products giant Kimberly-Clark, which owns Kleenex and Huggies, said last week that it would buy Kenvue, the maker of Tylenol, for $40 billion. The announcement came as Kenvue was facing a barrage of unproven claims that linked the pain reliever to autism. Shares of Kenvue plummeted as Trump administration officials began asserting that acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, was linked to autism. After the deal announcement, Kimberly-Clark's share price fell more than 10% to its lowest level since 2018. Kenvue's stock price rose about 15%. Kenvue makes products like Listerine, Neutrogena, and Johnson's Baby Shampoo. Kimberly-Clark has been eyeing Kenvue for months, and the two have been in talks since July, the New York Times reported. Some analysts have requested more clarity on how Kimberly-Clark would handle potential legal liabilities, pointing to the lawsuits by families claiming that their children were diagnosed with autism or ADHD after taking the drug during pregnancy. Studies of acetaminophen used in pregnancy have yielded mixed results, the Times reported. Kenvue, which was spun off from Johnson & Johnson in 2023, also sells baby powder products that have been the subject of legal trouble since before the split. Johnson & Johnson has tried to settle tens of thousands of claims, alleging that the company was aware that the talcum previously used in its products caused cancer. In response to questions about litigation related to both talc and Tylenol, Kirk Perry, the chief executive of Kenvue, said that the company stood firmly behind the science and the safety of our products. The turmoil surrounding Tylenol helped the company buy Kenvue at a discounted price. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Be prepared for the end of this long bull market. Big stock gains have always been followed by big losses. Here are precautions you can take. The higher the AI bull market goes, the more nervous I get, so I've been thinking about whether I protected myself sufficiently for a crash. This isn't because I'm predicting an imminent market crisis, not at all. Despite warnings from prominent bank executives and hedge fund managers that the stock market has gotten too high, I believe the frenzy for artificial intelligence and for stock riches is likely to keep the market moving upward for a while. Fabulous wealth is being generated in the stock market. NVIDIA at least briefly reached a $5 trillion total market valuation, Microsoft topped 4 trillion, so did Apple. The numbers are so big they are hard to comprehend. They reflect stock prices that strike me as excessive. Sooner or later, the market will take a serious plunge. Stock markets always do. President Trump's deliberately disruptive policies have only heightened that risk. As a long-term, low-cost index fund investor who has already benefited from decades of an upwardly trending stock market, I'm not abandoning stocks. I've resolved long ago to stick with the market, and that decision has paid off. But I'm reviewing how much I've got at stake, how much in stocks and in bonds, and assessing what the effects would be for my overall investments if stocks were to plunge as deeply as they did in the 4 U.S. bear markets since the start of 2000. The question is whether I'm sufficiently diversified and hold enough bonds and other assets after the big run-up in stock prices. It may seem perverse to be concerned about potential market losses during a period of remarkable gains. After all, if you have owned an S&P 500 index fund since the start of the current bull market on October 12, 2022, you have doubled your money. But terrible stock market declines happen with shocking regularity. Diversification or owning a variety of assets has helped to ease the pain in the past. When the stock market is better than expected, it's worth remembering how bad it could suddenly become. The dark side, bear markets are conventionally defined as price declines of at least 20% from top to bottom. There have been many of them, 15 for the S&P 500 and its predecessors, starting with the crash of 1929, according to a tally by Howard Silverblatt, a senior index analyst for S&P Dow Jones Indices. Those were all painful episodes. Since 2000, the bear market set off by the financial crisis of 2007-08 was the worst in terms of total losses. The S&P 500 dropped 56.8% from top to bottom. That horrible stretch started on October 9, 2007, and lasted 17 months before ending on March 9, 2009, according to Mr. Silverblatt. What made it even worse was that it came only 5 years after another, more protracted bear market, the dot-com crash of the early 2000s. That decline lasted 30.5 months from March 24, 2000 to October 9, 2002. The S&P 500 fell 49.1% from top to bottom. Between the two crashes, there was a bull market in which the S&P 500 index rose 101.5%. That's a tremendous number, except for a basic math problem that affects all bear markets. When stocks decline 50%, as does the dot-com bear market almost did, they must rise 100% to get back to where they started. If you began with $100 and lost half of it, you need to double your remaining $50 to return to $100. Investors who stuck with the S&P 500 index after the dot-com crash were still hurting a decade later. The numbers are sobering. Those unfortunate enough to have bought S&P 500 index funds at the March 2000 peak were sitting on a loss of 8.3%, including dividends, a decade later, according to calculations I ran on FactSet. That didn't happen in isolation. There were also 2 recessions in the course of those 2 market downturns. Entire industries were battered. Millions of people lost their jobs. Those entering retirement or already in it endured grievous setbacks. Could something that bad or worse happen now? Yes, of course. And far worse has happened in the U.S. stock market when you go back as far as the Great Depression for the 1920s and 1930s. Using inflation-adjusted data, Robert Shiller, a Nobel laureate in economics, found that it took 29 years to recover from the stock market crash of 1929. These kinds of stories become ubiquitous during severe downturns. Focusing on them could scare you away from the stock market entirely, but I think that would be a mistake too. Pain and gain. Sticking with the stock market for the long run has been the secret of investing, hidden in plain sight. As I pointed out this summer, over 60 years, the S&P 500 generated a return of 38,881.17%. That means that $1,000 invested 60 years ago would have been worth about $390,000 in late June, as long as you stuck with it, even though terrible downturns. The U.S. market has been good over many shorter but still lengthy periods. Just go back to the start of 2000. Despite 4 bear markets in 2020 and 2022, in addition to the 2 in the first decade of the century, The S&P 500 in this period has returned 8.1% annualized with dividends for a total gain of 652%. By contrast, bond investments took paltry. The Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, a benchmark for investment-grade bonds, returned only 4.1% annualized for a total gain of 181%. Correction, the S&P 500 in this period has returned 8.1% annualized with dividends for a total gain of 652%. By contrast, bond investments look paltry. So if you didn't care about those stretches of stock declines, you would have been better off just owning the stock index fund. Or if you were present enough to pick the best stock in the market, just going with NVIDIA. That stock's gains since the start of 2000 make nearly all the others look insignificant, 34.9% annualized or 230,607% cumulatively. Yet it would have taken a stronger stomach than I possess to have survived a naked investment with no protection at all, either in the broad stock market or in a stock like NVIDIA. In one 11th-month stretch, starting in November 11, 2021, for instance, NVIDIA lost more than 60% of its value. That's why I cling to bonds and other less exciting holdings, like bank deposits and money market funds, and why I'm looking at them closely now. Searching for safety in most but not all bear markets, investment-grade bonds have been a blessing. For example, in the decades starting March 24th of 2000, encompassing two bear markets, the S&P 500 was down more than 8%, but the Vanguard Total Bond Index Fund returned 79.8%, for an annualized 6%, it was wonderful to have owned bonds then. Bonds haven't always provided that kind of protection, though. Take the bear market of 2022, the value of bonds fell along with that of stocks. That's because inflation soared and interest rates rose. Interest rates or yields move in the opposite direction of bond prices. At the moment, in part because of Mr. Trump's tariffs, inflation is still running at an uncomfortably high rate, so the outlook is uncertain for bonds. With a government shutdown underway, insufficient public data for clarity, rising government debt, and an embattled Federal Reserve coming under pressure from the Trump administration, it's possible that inflation will rise sharply again. Treasury bills with a duration of 1 year or less and money market funds have excelled in the past few years, as I pointed out last week. While their yield has dropped below 4%, money market funds are still producing an annualized return over 3%. Which could move higher if inflation flares again and the rates rise. Under each circumstance, while government inflation-protected bonds would be havens, core bond funds would be hard-pressed to produce positive returns. Then again, the remarkably resilient economy could falter, which would push interest rates lower, bolster bond returns, and hurt money market funds and treasury bill rates. For greater margins of safety in a severe downturn, bank savings accounts covered by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation would be preferable to uninsured money market funds. I don't know where the economy is heading or how long the stock market will rise before its next big reversal. The old 60-40 portfolio with 60% in stocks and 40% in high-quality bonds is a traditional compromise between risk and safety. I include some short-term funds within that 40% fixed income allocation, and I invest globally because the outstanding performance of the U.S. stock market may not last. If you're going to take the risk of investing in stocks, particularly during a stock market rally that seems to have been swept by excessive enthusiasm, it's critically important to be ready for setbacks, even severe ones. On a stock chart covering many decades, bear markets have looked like minor blips on a long ride upward, but try to figure out what you'll be able to handle before the stock market's intoxication with artificial intelligence ends abruptly. With power comes great responsibility. Electricity bills are higher than usual, and many Americans blame AI. The increasing ubiquitous technology consumes enormous amounts of power. Hundreds of billions of dollars in deals have been struck to build data centers all over the United States and beyond. Electricity use at U.S. data centers could triple by 2028, according to the Energy Department, when data centers alone could account for 12% of total electricity consumption. Can the grid cope? Calvin Butler, who runs one of the largest utility companies in the United States, is in the hot seat. His company, Exelon, manages the electricity supply for more than 10 million customers. It owns 6 regional utilities, including ComEd in Illinois, PECO in Pennsylvania, and BGE in Maryland. The company's share price is up more than 20% this year, outperforming the market and highlighting how the frenzy over artificial intelligence has transformed the normally boring, heavily regulated utility industry. That's not necessarily a cause for celebration among Exelon's longstanding household and commercial customers. More demand, less supply, everyone else's costs go up, Mr. Butler, age 56, said. Exelon oversees transmission and distribution, but its utilities are prevented by state regulations from generating the energy that flows through the grid. Mr. Butler, who is also the chair of the Edison Electric Institute, an industry association, wants to change that. In the meantime, Exelon said it would spend $38 billion over the next 4 years to upgrade its infrastructure. And in acknowledging concerns about bills, in the summer the company announced a $50 million customer relief fund to help offset costs for low and middle income users as demand increases and supply is not there to meet it. This interview has been edited and condensed. With the rapid rise of AI and its effect on electricity bills, can you compare this moment to any other time in your career? No, the energy industry will go through more change and transformation in the next 10 years than it has in the last 100. The industry has been considered slow and steady, some would describe as sleepy, and now it's in the forefront of everything. We say that the energy industry is 5% of GDP, but we power the next 95. How do you deal with the large and urgent demand for power from data centers? We don't generate 1 kilowatt. My focus has always been on the infrastructure, the grid, but now because of affordability and the lack of supply, utilities like ours should be able to get back into the generation business. What do you make of tech companies building data centers and trying to generate their own power? Is that a good strategy? If they can bring their own generation to the table, even better. The more generation assets we have, the better off we'll all be because your bill will be lower. On TikTok, everyone is complaining about paying more for electricity. Do you see a straight line from AI data centers to higher electricity bills? I wouldn't necessarily make the direct causal effect. The increased demand for electricity is not just about data center growth. It's also onshoring of manufacturing electric vehicles and quantum computing. It's your big screen TV, but it's the biggest part of the boom of data center growth. Yes? Are we building too many data centers too fast? If the demand doesn't materialize, does it still make sense to build new infrastructure like substations? It does because everything we do is not always about one customer. We're making the system more reliable and more resilient by adding additional capacity to it. Are we in an AI bubble? I do not think so. I do not believe the load that some predict is going to come to fruition. I do not believe it's 10 times larger. I think it may be 3 to 5 times, but that's still significant load growth. People who live near data centers are really fed up by them. What lessons have you learned from that? When you're building a new transmission line or a substation, it has to be done with the community. Not everyone's going to like what you're doing, but they will never be in a position to say that they didn't know. We have adjusted some of our plans because of feedback. It should be shifting a line a quarter of a mile instead of going through someone's farm. And we say that the cost of making that adjustment is X. Are you all okay with that? Is it possible to meet climate goals given this once-in-a-century ramp-up that we need? We said by 2025 we were going to have 30% of our vehicle fleet electrified. We met that goal. Cities have put out very aggressive climate plans. Still, I don't generate any electricity. Their plans have nothing to do with me. Internally, we're driving what we do to net zero. Our cities need to ask that question because they're trying to meet the load growth and keep prices affordable. Many of those climate plans didn't include natural gas. You cannot meet this demand without gas. Let's talk about your upbringing in St. Louis. Tell me about your parents. Growing up in St. Louis was wonderful. Mom and Dad divorced early, and my dad moved to Springfield, Illinois, where I would spend summers. I was raised really by my mom. She was my best friend, and we were close. Most of your life lessons you get from your parents, both good and bad. I lost my mom when she was 47. She died of colon cancer. I remember people used to come by the house to visit while she was sick, and she would spend 95% of the time talking about how they were doing and just leaning into them. Even though she was in pain, you would never know it because for her, it was about uplifting others. Your father worked at a power plant that ComEd used to own. What did you learn from him? He spent 20-plus years working as a troubleshooter. He definitely talked to me about work ethic. He would save all the chores around the house until I visited him in the summer. He was always stressing, never be afraid of hard work and never let anyone outwork you. And now you run the company. I think about my dad. I lost him when he was 67 to pancreatic cancer. I know he would be proud, and I'm not too far removed from the fact that he was a laborer in the plant that was a small portion of the company that I now run. That means something to me. When you were young, what did you think you were going to do when you grew up? My dad always said I'd make a good lawyer, but I didn't know any lawyers. I'm the first one in my family to have graduated from college. And you ended up getting a law degree? How did that influence your path to the CEO? Lawyers are trained to make an abundance of information and synthesize. My ability to actively discuss and debate issues in real time is also very important to me as a CEO, but I have to recognize that I work with a lot of engineers and a lot of finance people. They don't like that active debate. You seem to relish reaching out to young people, like going to high schools to talk about engineering. That's playing the long game, right? We have to invest in them. Someone saw something in me and invested in me. I think it's my obligation to show up for them and say, I'm special, but you're also very special. If they come work for us, great. But I want them to know that they can do anything. I didn't know a CEO growing up until I got to college. You are often talking to black and brown students during those school visits. Those are largely considered DEI. What is the risk of those programs going away in the current political environment? We're going to continue to encourage the best and the brightest. Our values don't change with administrations. I tell students that you don't get jobs because you're a woman or you're black or you're a Latino. You get jobs because you're good. At Exelon, we have opportunities for you and you will be able to shine. I had this conversation with my senior leadership team and they were locked in. I had the same conversation with my board. Lightning round. What's the best hack to lower your electricity bill? Turn off your lights. What have you learned from your company's youngest workers? Mr. Butler, we don't have to wear ties. What's the last thing you worked at AI? How is our stock performing and what do analysts think of Exelon? What's your biggest pet peeve as CEO? People disrespecting coworkers. How many direct reports is too many? As many as you can handle. And how do you sign off your emails? Thank you for all you do, Calvin. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In this house, here a kitchen, there a kitchen. Ask the chef, Andrew Zimmerman, when he arrived in the Twin Cities, and he'll respond with unsparing detail. The night of January 28, 1992, I had tried to kill myself, 4 or 5 days earlier, and I was at the end of my rope, a horrible user of people and a taker of things, and an active addict and alcoholic. By then, he had no home, so he found room at a flop house in New York, where he woke up days after eating a fistful of barbiturates and drinking a bottle of vodka, he said. He managed to call a friend and try something new, ask for help. Help arrived in the form of a ticket to Minneapolis and a spot at the treatment center now known as the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. Mr. Zimmern, age 64, has remained in the Twin Cities ever since. The recovering community here and the food community have loved me up at a time when I wasn't able to love myself, he said. Without those people, I wouldn't have anything. Perhaps the clearest example of what he does have, a 3,600 square foot spread purchased just before the COVID-19 pandemic, then reimagined and renovated, is something he prizes more than most. Designed in the 80s by the local architect Keith Waters, who is known for soaring ceilings, curved walls, and copious windows, the house sits on more than 2 acres. Mr. Zimmern particularly loves the North Norwegian red pines, which are offset by sculptural tufts of Scottish fescue. I know a lot of people who have gone from quote-unquote rags to riches and don't have any gratitude, Mr. Zimmern said. By contrast, he's well aware of his ridiculously good fortune. Sure, you say, oh, I'm going to make a TV show, he said, referring to his early aughts breakout series, Bizarre Foods. Still, you never think it's actually going to work or become popular or become a legacy show that then allows you to do lots of other shows and be part of pop culture. His latest project is the Blue Food Cookbook, created as a companion piece to Hope in the Water, the PBS series Mr. Zimmern produced about ocean conservation and sustainable seafood. Co-written by the chef Barton Seaver, the book speaks on behalf of our oceans and lakes and rivers, asking people to be better, he said. The recipes Mr. Zimmern contributed to the Blue Food Cookbook were all cooked here for the first time, he said, and in some cases that work was the first place they were perfected. He added, gesturing toward the range, that walk, a jumbo carbon steel workhorse from Yasukata, sits atop a purpose-built burner, one of six cooking surfaces, on a range designed to Mr. Zimmern's specifications. For all the kitchen's sleek surfaces and gleaming appliances, however, the profusion of life-worn miscellany is what makes the space his own. One item is heavy rotation. His great-grandmother's salt cellar was part of a bridal inheritance that each generation of his family passed down as per Jewish tradition of the day, he said. I know that my great-grandmother reached into the salt cellar the same way that I am reaching into the salt cellar, and there's something very, very cool about that. Another heirloom dates back even further. We think the carving set is from before our family came to this country in the 1840s from Germany, and it was probably made in the late 1700s or early 1800s, he said, adding, it's the only way to touch my relatives. Perhaps not coincidentally, they worked as meat cutters upon arrival in the United States. When conceiving a kitchen, Mr. Zimmerman said the designers lay out their vision and say, okay, this is going to cost $8 billion. From there, he said, you pare it back, but this stovetop faucet was relatively inexpensive to do and extremely handy. He also uses it to display relics of turkeys and chickens past. These serve as a good reminder of life, death, and the vagaries of our existence, he said. It also goes well with this photo, which looks like a meal, but it's all rotted food, he pointed out. The photo is Blue Plate Special by the director, John Waters. It's a reminder to me of how lucky I am. Of so many places around the world, that is dinner, he said. This being Andrew Zimmern's home, the living room is an extension of the kitchen. The outsized fireplace provides far more than warmth. Winter often means cooking over a coal bed in the fireplace using custom grates. There are also hooks hidden in the roof of the fireplace, and he cooks chicken on a string or a wire alongside a tray of sides. Some of his favorite vessels for fireplace cooking are the lime green and chartreuse South African pots that sit on the hearth. I'll tell you, if you are making a beef stew and you cook it over a coal bed for 2 hours in one of those pots, it will taste radically different than if I did it on my stovetop, Mr. Zimmer said. Mr. Zimmern displays a wide variety of prints and paintings and photographs in the main hallway. He frequently gives food photos as a gift to chefs who participate in an annual dinner to support the housing, nutrition, and health efforts of New York's services for the unserved. Here's one he wanted for himself, Bernice Abbott's Blossom Restaurant, 103 Bowery, Manhattan. I mean, the prices, the gaze, the fact that he looks like Peyton Manning, Mr. Zimmer's favorite element and the easiest to miss, the young lady just staring off into space. The kitchen may be Mr. Zimmer's primary domain, but the guitar room is a close second. I'm a frustrated musician, he said. I have a condition in my hands. I can't really close my left hand fully, just too many years of working with them. So I've become worse as time goes on, but I love collecting guitars. The wall art, particularly a photo from 2018, brings him almost as much joy. One of the greatest experiences of my life was playing with Cheap Trick at an outdoor concert, Mr. Zimmern said, explaining that he'd been standing on the side of the stage and that they were fans of Bizarre Foods. He was summoned up, handed one of Rick Nielsen's guitars, he is one of the most famous guitar collections in the world, and swept into rousing renditions of Surrender and Want You to Want Me. He's actually telling me what chords to play, Mr. Zimmern said of the photo. That's an original Winterland poster, Mr. Zimmern said of his Grateful Dead poster. One of his favorite elements took some time to discover. I owned this for a couple years before I realized it's 9 p.m. to 9 a.m., he admitted, and way down here, $7 includes breakfast, a concert feature he'd like to bring back. Moving outside the house, Mr. Zimmern has built another hotbed of food prep, an adjunct kitchen with no fewer than 9 kinds of grills, 10 if you count the fire pit. The showstopper is a grill made by Fogues TX. They sell a dozen different models, he said, noting this is, I think, their most extensive one, and you can cook for a gazillion people. Off that, because of all the different areas and spaces, some possibilities, a plancha, rotisserie, a conventional grill, baskets to hang, 25 chickens if you wanted to, and a press that can accommodate a whole pig, lamb, or deer. We are the key fulcrums of the economy, and if we leave, everything will collapse. Abhijit Banerjee, an MIT professor who shares a Nobel Memorial Prize in economic sciences on how he believes rich business people think. I'm worried about younger folks not knowing how to conduct a traditional Google search. Shiri Mahmood, a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania on AI search tools, chatbots, and social media's contribution to lower cognitive performance. When the court said pay the benefits, they didn't say pay half a hamburger. Senator Amy Kohlbacher, Democrat of Minnesota, on the Trump's administration plan to make partial food stamp payments. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 9th issue of the New York Times business section. Your reader has been Claudia, and I thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service is the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 4 of Everything is Tuberculosis by John Green. Stay with us for these readings and more. Thank you.
The following program is